Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Good evening and welcome to Views of the News, the show that this week is going to examine exceptional journalism, from movie reviews to in-depth and investigative reporting, and the business models that may or may not support it. I'm your substitute host, Lee Wilkins, and with me in the Reynolds Journalism Institute studio, our regular panelist, Charles Davis, whose academic specialty is media law and within that public access to information, and guest panelist and journalism faculty colleague, Amy Simons, a member of the school's Convergence Sequence and fellow political junkie. We're going to begin in Amy's hometown, Chicago, and with the death this week of film critic Roger Ebert. Ebert is widely credited with elevating the role of critic to one whose efforts were lauded by both the film industry and the movie-going public. We'll talk about critics and criticism, whether they are worth paying attention to, and why. Ebert himself was so successful in an industry that, in general, seems to value predictability over opinion. That value of predictability, in this case of income, brings us to our next topic, whether a recent court decision upholding the right of Aereo, a broadcast service that scoops up the signals from local television stations, which continue to broadcast over the air, and streams them to your computer for free, is really the game changer that some in the industry are saying. Corporate executives, including Fox Network, which got its financial start by providing edgy entertainment for a younger audience, have threatened to take the entire network exclusively to cable. NBC Universal has sued, again, with the same implied threat. We'll talk about what this might mean, both locally and nationally, and how the major changes in how we access television content portend changes of just this sort. Next, we'll take a look at two journalistic efforts, one local and the second an effort to, and the second international, for an effort to distinguish in-depth from investigative reporting and whether such work is a distinction without a difference. The Kansas City Star on Sunday published a full-page investigative report on why shutoff valves for gas lines are so seldom used. You'll recall that about a month ago, 8 people died in a gas line explosion in a Kansas City restaurant. Then we'll introduce you to and begin to evaluate the effort by more than 60 journalists in 38 countries to investigate tax havens for the rich, both corporate and human. And yes, the report named names. Speaking of naming names, at the end of the show, we will devote time to the concept of opposition research from the point of view of the current Senate Minority Leader, Republican Mitch McConnell, whose ugly discussion of how he planned to campaign against potential opponent Ashley Judd was leaked to Mother Jones magazine, which published it. McConnell has called foul, calling in the FBI, and in a blender-like metaphor, blamed the political left for Nixonian tactics. But since no one would believe these events if you saw them in the movies, Amy, let's start with the movies. Yeah. Why is Roger Ebert important, not just to filmgoers, but to journalists who review everything from the latest gadget to local restaurants?
Well, I think Robert Feeder, who is a longtime media reporter and columnist who worked for the Chicago Sun-Times and most recently Time Out Chicago, summed it up in his tribute that he published as soon as word came down that Roger Ebert died best. It was three simple words, the best ever. And that was his entire first response in Obit. And Roger Ebert created a generation and a legacy that we're all going to remember, both as journalists and as the public.
Charles, why do you think Ebert was so well accepted, not just by readers and later viewers, but by the industry he sometimes criticized?
Well, he was very shrewd. He was really, if you think about it, one of the first. We have all these online news workshops these days on personal branding. Ebert was a master at personal branding before anybody even knew personal branding was a thing. Mm-hmm. He was doing it, 30 years ago?
If not
more. He created this identity for himself as public critic. And he turned himself into a PBS phenomenon with the show, which then became what Broadcast Network picked it up. I mean, it became a cultural phenomenon.
Well,
Siskel and Ebert, and that was their own doing.
Let's take a minute and take a look at a very early clip of Siskel and Ebert.
Don't get the idea that this picture is good simply because it puts TV down. It's the way it puts it down, with fine performances and some very funny and foul-mouthed writing.
Gene, I agree and disagree. I agree in the first place that it's, along with you, I agree it's my favorite Christmas movie. I also think Rocky comes in very close second. I disagree that it's overwritten. I think that one of the nice things about the movie is that it's written.
That's a movie network, interestingly enough, that is considered now iconic.
Yeah.
I play it in class this very semester. But I think one of the things about Ebert, at least it always struck me, is that he consistently promoted excellence, and he wasn't afraid to say that if something didn't live up to his standards. I mean, Amy, how does that work? Because you're costing people money when you do that sort of thing.
But you know what? The industry supported it, because when he called something bad, he was able to support and point out what made it bad. And, you know, Rahm Emanuel even said at the funeral service the other day, he watched a lot of bad movies, so we didn't have to. And when he called something bad, it's because it was. He had the credibility to back up. He wasn't just taking pot shots at certain actors or certain directors or certain production companies. He backed it up because the content was bad.
Well, Charles, one of the things that it brings up to mind for me is, you know, what standards should prevail when a critic says something is bad? I mean, movies, I think we sort of all access, but there's restaurant reviews, there's local theater reviews, there's local music reviews. I mean, if somebody comes to review your kid's concert at, you know, say, Hickman High School, do they get to say, do you use the same kind of standards that, say, Ebert did for film?
Clearly not. And one of the things that made Ebert was he worked opinion. And this is something we talk to our students about, is the fact that, especially these days, people think that the only qualification for being an opinionated writer or a critic is just merely to spout off. And he was not spouting off. This was a man who made himself learned in cinematic arts in a way that he could speak authoritatively with evidence to the opinions that he was offering forth. So he worked a column, a review, the way you want someone to work it, and that is repertorially.
So, Amy, is that the sense that you get to? I mean, I know that the Tribune, for example, mm-hmm. has gotten in major trouble for having someone blast a local production because people say, "Yeah, this isn't Broadway. The same standards ought not to apply."
I think that the same standards ought not to apply. You have to look at it when you're being critical of a production or of a restaurant or what's going on in that situation. You can't expect that an actor who's working a stage in Columbia, Missouri, or who may be a student actor, is going to have the same sense of timing or the same sense of delivery as somebody who's on Broadway. People work an entire lifetime to be able to make it onto to the great white way.
Okay, well, Charles, we're going to move along because we got a lot to cover, but I think we're all going to need help on this next one because, quite frankly, I'll admit the story itself caught me by surprise. So why is what Aereo does legal, assuming that the court ruling that was handed down last week prevails?
That's a massive assumption because, pardon the pun, but the jury is very much still out on whether or not this is legal. What they do effectively is put a tiny microchip-sized antenna, quote-unquote, in the device that is bringing broadcast into the home. So whether it's cable, over-the-air broadcast, or the internet, if you install this device on whatever device it is you want to watch on, then it will take the broadcast signal out of the sky, reprogram it into a subscription-based service, and then render it to an iPad or a computer. Or a monitor, for that matter, if you want to put it on your plasma on the wall. So what they're doing is taking, see if we can wrap our brains around this, they're taking a free over-the-air service, but a free over-the-air service that was constituted for the purpose of delivering advertising into over-the-air households in order to support the revenue model. And they are intercepting it and reprogramming it into a subscription-based service that will allow you to skip commercials, to record whole shows and fly right past the commercials. And so, not surprisingly, the networks are crying foul. A federal judge ruled that they couldn't, he refused to enjoin them. So legally, that's a little bit different than saying it's okay. All he said is, I'm not going to enjoin you pending this litigation. That's a very minimalist judicial intervention. We'll now see what the federal courts actually do with this. Fox came out at the National Association of Broadcasters meeting this week and flat out said, if they prevail, if the streaming company prevails on this thing and Arrow can continue to do this, we're going off over the air broadcast television because we have no incentive to be there anymore, which was a huge statement.
Amy, in a way, don't we have only ourselves in some ways to blame for this? I mean, we teach in Convergent. We teach students, you know, get pictures from here, video from there, audio from someplace
we
else.
We may do teach them to do that, but we also teach them to be mindful of who owns the copyrights on those things and that you can't just right-click on a photo and republish it as your own. Which leaves me, frankly, as I read about this and even hear Charles talk about, I'm baffled by the whole thing. I'm still having a hard time getting my head around it because I see both sides of it.
Well, I think at one level, we shouldn't be surprised at all. I mean, this is how a lot of us watch television. It certainly is how my 30-year-old daughter and her husband watch television. They don't do cable, and they certainly don't have those old-fashioned things called rabbit ears. They're pulling them, all their TV, onto their laptops through subscriptions to things like Hulu and Netflix and what have you. So, Charles, I mean, I know we don't know how it's going to come out, but is this as big a threat potentially as what Fox at least is trying to make it?
Absolutely. Well, I don't know if it's threat. It's reordering. It will be a reordering of the television ecosystem. If a couple of the big over-the-air networks say, we're not over-the-air anymore, yeah. And they move to subscription only, that's going to ripple down to retransmission. Cable companies go to these networks and negotiate fees for content that they then re-air on their stations, right? So this is going to have a huge ripple effect on the retransmission market, which right now, if you look at retransmission, premium cable gets the highest fees, and it sort of goes down. Over-the-air broadcasters they get pennies on the dollar for their content, and that's because over here they're giving it away, mm-hmm. right? If they stop giving it away, they'll effectively become premium content. Guess what that means to the consumer? That means the consumer pays for it. Everything. So when you say we are our worst enemy, we are, but for reasons maybe a little different than you'd expect. We're doing ourselves in by coming up with lots of clever ways to steal television. Sorry.
You know, like sharing our HBO Go passwords.
And what we'll end up doing is sticking ourselves right in the leg because these companies will figure it out. Give them time. Mm-hmm. They're going to get money for content that they are spending millions on, or they're not going to do the content.
Well, one of the things it's impossible to do this show without acknowledging is that the university and the School of Journalism have a financial interest in how all of this comes out because, A, we use television station KOMU as a teaching tool, mm-hmm. but B, KOMU is broadcast over the air. It's essentially free TV,
and it
brings in a lot of revenue to the campus.
And we've seen KOMU get into disputes with both DirecTV and MediaCom,
yep.
where MediaCom even pulled KOMU off of the channel lineup for, what was that, 3 or 4 days at a time a couple years ago.
So, I mean, what does this all mean, or can we say yet what this all means? I mean, is it just another place that KOMU is now going to have to bargain, or is the university itself going to have to sort of rethink how it uses that station and the revenue that it brings in? Charles? Sorry.
I mean, if you look down the road, I don't know, a long way, 20, 30 years, I have no idea in which way the local affiliate model will change, but it's hard to envision a future in which the local affiliate model will stay completely unchanged. I mean, if you go to NBC.com and you download content that NBC is making available direct to the consumer without dealing with the local affiliate at all, it doesn't, I don't think, take a whole lot of prognostication to realize, like, why do we need a physical plant sitting in the middle of a cow pasture off I-63 if they can just put it on the computer and send it to me? And that makes my head hurt thinking about it, because what that does to local news is truly horrific.
Well, and I think one of the issues then will become, is there a market not for the consumption of local news, but a market that will support the production of local news, which, as we all know, even with student labor, is incredibly expensive. So, Amy, I mean, does that do something to change how we're going to be doing journalism?
As expensive as it is, though, even with the student labor, look at the number of hours of programming that local stations are producing in newscasts. They are dropping syndicated programming. They are dropping other types of programming because it's cheaper to produce a newscast than it actually is to bring in other programming. So I don't see stations dropping that just yet, because it is cheaper to have a new newscast than it is to get somebody else to come after Rachel Ray.
And it may mean that the local affiliates will at some point – actually, let's turn this on its head. They may reevaluate their relationship to the network. The network may become an independent, subscription-only purveyor of premium content, of which they might grab some if you're KOMU. But otherwise, KOMU might go and get content a la carte from a variety of different providers. In other words, decouple from the network and become an independent affiliate. I could certainly see a world in which that could happen. Well, that's pretty crazy, but it's not totally crazy.
Well,
it could happen.
And as Amy said, if part of that content is local news, then actually in some ways that might be good for us. Well, I'd like to turn next to a sort of local story and a big-time international story that raised at least the same set of questions for me, and that is, what's the difference between in-depth reporting, the Kansas City Star piece on the fact that nobody shuts their gas line valves off, even in case of fire and other things, and the mega investigative journalism piece that came out, I guess, on Thursday of last week, which, as I understand it, involved journalists from 60 journalists from more than 38 countries, which essentially took a look at the tax havens that not the people around this table necessarily can take advantage of. So, Charles, what do both efforts tell us about sort of the state of either in-depth or investigative journalism today?
It's a great question. Well, I mean, investigative journalism, I think, is journalism that other people don't want you to tell.
Yep.
And boy, oh boy, does the tax haven story fit it beautifully. The pipeline story, interestingly, I think maybe is another angle of investigative journalism, and that is journalism that shows system failure. Maybe no evil wrongdoer at the end of the day, maybe just a system that's not working, right? We spent some time this week with a friend of mine, Ian Urbina, from the New York Times, who was in visiting, and he was talking about a story he had just done on OSHA and a chemical that's used in the gluing of furniture that is giving people neurotoxic diseases. Same sort of story. The system is broken down. There is no one person you can point to and say, aha, like you can in this tax haven story. You can point to a whole lot of people and say, aha. Nonetheless, both are incredibly important, because we don't fix things that are broken unless we have this sort of systematic, very, very rigorous reporting.
So, Amy, I'm going to start with a Kansas City story because for some reason that's what traveled across my desk first. I thought what was interesting about it was not just the depth that they'd gone into, which was interesting, and the people that they'd gotten to comment, including companies that said, well, no, actually, we don't install these because it's not economically viable. But also the fact that they literally thought to ask the question, how come wasn't this one valve used in this particular instance? So I was just curious. I mean, to me, that seems like the sort of story that could have been done well in Convergence. It could have been done well for broadcast. It was just essentially, to me, asking a really smart question and then digging.
And digging. And the part that makes us good, effective, in-depth journalism is it takes a really complicated concept and explains it at a level that can be understood by people who have no idea how either gas delivery or the engineering involved would work. And that's what a good in-depth story does. You're right. It would have been a great opportunity for other interactive features that I could even think of two or three off the top of my head in terms of diagrams and graphics and in interactivity that could have been brought into it to tell it in an even more accessible way.
Well, Charles, I was at a conference last week where one of the journalists in a very soft voice said that he thought that investigative reporting actually was having some sort of a resurgence. I don't necessarily want to say that he was crazy. Actually, it was a chief investigative reporter for CNBC who's very well known. But I thought that the tax haven story maybe gave a little bit of credibility to that claim because it was so internationally done.
Well, I guess my take on it is there are fewer people doing better work than ever before. The investigative work that is being done is spectacular. And the methods and the collaborative experimentation that's taking place is evidenced by this story, which, by the way, was led logistically by a J School alum, a woman named Marina Walker.
I knew you were going to get that in there.
who is just a fabulous, fabulous journalist. That sort of, and by the way, this sort of collaborative, cooperative approach is becoming all the rage in reporting circles these days, and it's born of necessity.
Right.
It's born of economic necessity, but it's wonderful. Conversations that wouldn't even have taken place 10, 15 years ago because no two journalists would ever sit down in the room and talk about working on a story together. It was anathema. Now people have these conversations all the time, and great projects are born as a result.
Well, Amy, one of the things I thought was really interesting about the tax haven story, yeah, and it sort of, in a way, flips in on its head, too, is we have some very wealthy people in Missouri, people that if you say the phrase tax haven, people mm-hmm. might think, oh, I wonder if that person is taking advantage of that. So my question is do you think that there's going to be any local media follow through about our extremely wealthy folks in St. Louis or Kansas City or, dare I say it, even here in Columbia, Missouri?
No.
Why not? I knew you were going to say that.
To do a story like this is hard. This is the type of story that takes a great understanding on the part of the reporters and the editors who are working on it to be able to report on it in a way that's knowledgeable and credible. And I don't know that we have the strength and depth here to be able to do that in a way that brings that level of strength and credibility that you would see in the Washington Post, that you saw in the Guardian, that you saw in the work that CBC did on this story. I don't know that we have that here right now to be able to do the story in the way that it would do it justice.
Charles, so we're going to know globally what's going on, but not in mid-Missouri?
Maybe so. Well, and it's largely because this was a leak. I mean, this was a series that was born of a leak. The documents themselves, apparently, what was the number of documents? You know, WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks caught a firestorm when it released
like two or three
gigabytes.
Times, I think, yeah,
2 gigabytes. These were 200 gigabytes of information. First of all, it would take a team of reporters of this level of expertise and time and money to get at those documents in a way that's not just poisonously libelous.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the main reason, like a local news organization, even if they saw a name in this list and went, wait a minute, that guy lives in Moberly. I still think they're going to be fantastically reluctant to say, yep, that's him. Because just the getting from that may be the guy who lives in Moberly to that indeed is the guy that lives in Moberly is a huge amount of work.
So, Amy, so is it really, I mean, one of the things that's always struck me about this sort of story is that the rich get to play on a different playing field in some way. I mean, there are some things that if, you know, we saw an athlete, for example, well, we might try to follow that story. But if you have billions of dollars, let alone whether or not they're in onshore or offshore accounts, does that mean so from local media, you essentially get to skate free?
I don't know if that's what it means. I almost look at it more, and it's the same way that I said that this story is hard. People understand athletes. It's easier to go after somebody you understand. You understand what they do. You understand what their motivation is. You understand, and on some level, even if you've played a game of pickup basketball, you know how to be critical of somebody who's playing basketball. To go after somebody in a situation like this, if you don't understand how they got themselves in the situation to begin with, it's really hard to go and possibly call them out for it.
Well,
Go ahead, Charles.
Well, and if they're just fantastically wealthy because they're fantastically wealthy, that's a titillating story. And it's like, ooh, look, rich people setting up tax havens. What I think, at least the stuff I read showed that was much more meaningful was, look, here's the finance the former finance minister of Mongolia, an impoverished nation with very real problems, mm-hmm. setting up a phony tax haven for himself with millions of dollars while serving as the finance minister of Mongolia. That just leads to a whole lot of other questions, which is, how much were they paying you, pal, and how did you end up with millions in an offshore tax haven? That's a very important question to ask.
I think so. I mean, I was struck by, among other things, once I tumbled to the story, it's timing, because as we all know, April the 15th is soon. So, you know, what better way to get people to pay attention to a story about taxes than to do this one? Okay, in the about 2 minutes that we have remaining, Amy, I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the Mitch McConnell-Ashley Judd flap, because I actually don't know what else to call it. Charles, I know McConnell is not one of your favorite political folks, but Amy, for starters, I mean,
Mitch McConnell.
Oh, yeah, you do. Can we start by talking about, is this the sort of opposition research that everybody does and we should just, quite frankly, get over it?
It probably is. Everybody's out there. Everybody's trying to dig up something. Some of the stuff, though, that was said in this tape that was published by
Mother Jones.
Mother Jones, I'm sorry. It just kind of seemed like something you'd want to roll your eyes at, you know? She's a Democrat. Okay, that's news to who? I mean, really.
The kind of nauseating part of it was how seriously they were discussing using the mental illness part and the depression part. Now, on the one hand, you could argue, well, she's been very public about that. But on the other, because someone has publicly discussed their depression does not make it grounds for a negative ad, Mr. McConnell. The conversation was so almost matter of fact about, I mean, it sounded like there was an undertone of, well, you know, it's here. This is ammo we can use. And there was clearly one guy in the conversation who had some sort of a moral compass, and he was kind of going, yeah, but overall, the whole thing is just incredibly, I found it. I mean, yes, everybody does oppo research, but it was more the context of that conversation that I just found fantastically disturbing. And it's probably why the good senator has reacted in his usual reserved manner.
In other words, he's called in the FBI.
Yes.
Yes, and claimed that he was bugged. A story actually which was still current as we are taping the show. Mm-hmm. Amy, I'm just curious, because Chicago politics has this sort of patina of, shall we say, a little bit of nastiness and a lot of other things. But do you think that overall, how does journalism combat this sort of stuff other than simply outing it? I mean, I keep wondering, are we past that point?
There's two approaches you can take. There's outing it or there's ignoring it. When you continue to give a candidate who's really just trying to use the media to create outrage to further his or her own agenda, what you're really doing is giving that person the platform to be able to spout off. And sometimes that's as irresponsible as ignoring something completely.
Well, once again, we've run out of time before we've run out of things to say. Mike McKean will be back in the host chair next week. My thanks to my journalism faculty colleagues, Charles Davis and Amy Simon. We couldn't bring this show to all of you without significant technical help ourselves, including director Travis McMillan and audio wizard Pat Akers. We'd love to hear from you on our blog about this story or others you think we should take a look at. And we've cached a lot of additional information about the stories we've discussed today on that blog. So, on this week, before your taxes are due, and assuming you aren't taking advantage of the tax havens we've discussed here, this is Lee Wilkins. For all of us at Views of the News, have a great evening.